and linear means.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you very much for the invitation. And sorry I couldn't be here yesterday. Of course, the danger is that I've missed all the exciting new discoveries.
You
and
solved
I...
all the problems, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, like questions. So it's if I blindly say old crap, just please correct me and, you know, and ask lots of questions. So I guess like this is a small audience, so a lot of interaction's fine. The other thing that I should say is that actually Willie should be the one that's giving this talk. This is really mostly his work, and also some of the earlier stuff with Fethi Ramazanoglu. But I guess it's not fair to have organizers speak, so I'm happy to do that service now, but all the difficult questions will go to Will. Okay, so this is going to be about this, the nonlinear regime of superradiance. I'll spend a little bit of time just sort of motivating why we want to look at this, what aspects of studies beyond the linear regime are interesting, and then also why it's challenging, why hasn't it been done before? This is a very old subject, several decades old. Why is it only in the last few years that we've got a few of these studies? And the answer is that it's computationally very expensive. And so before actually getting to the sort of the two results that I want to talk about, gravitational wave superradiance and Proker field superradiance, I want to spend a little bit of time on an algorithm that was sort of essential for us to get significant savings in cost, sort of a couple of orders of magnitude reduction in the cost. And this is this background error subtraction technique. And so one reason why I want to spend a little bit of time explaining it is because I think it's a very simple algorithm. It can be used in many, many situations like this where we have an analytic solution that perhaps at least in some regime of the problem where at some time, yeah, the initial time dominates the solution. And it's it's pretty easy to implement in existing code. So I think it's sufficiently useful that's not the point of this conference, but I want to spend a few minutes just talking about this and sort of encouraging people just to keep this in mind that at some point they might come across a problem where this could help significantly. And then the two results that I want to talk about, one is gravitational wave superradiance. So again, that's not quite relevant to this conference. This is about sort of particles and the axiverse and things like this. But this is sort of taking a black hole and scattering pure gravitational waves off the black hole and seeing the superradiant scattering of those black holes. And then the Proker field superradiance, which is perhaps more in line with the goals of this conference. Okay, so again, just a few sort of warm-up slides. Again, this audience doesn't need this, but I will just give a few for the completeness of a talk. So in your black hole radiance, super radiance, well, it's been known for a long time that there are many ways, or several ways, in which we can extract rotational energy from a black hole. And since the 60s already with the Penrose process, the Blanford-Zanayak mechanism, if there's sort of an accretion disk and magnetic fields around the black hole, and then particle superradiance, the scattering of bosonic fields of black holes. And so I'm not going to go into the motivations, in particular the astrophysical motivations for it, because I recommend that you all go to this conference. There's a lot of people there that will have explained what the motivation is yesterday. So superradiance, you know, it's not something that's unique to black holes. In fact, it occurs in many fields in flat space, you know, the Klein paradox. And actually, even in a simpler level, it's really just conservation of angular momentum and energy. So you imagine like taking a spinning wheel, you know, you throw a little particle or a marble off the wheel. If you just do things right, it's going to get shot up with much higher energy and angular momentum relative to the wheel. And the wheel is going to lose energy and angular momentum with respect to that. So, you know, there are many places in physics where this kind of scattering happens. It's perhaps interesting that it happens with black holes because black holes don't seem to be, it's not like a wheel. Black holes kind of suck everything in. They don't like to give things back. But of course here, nothing is coming out of the black hole. It's really the energy in the space-time around the black hole. But then what's perhaps interesting with black holes is the details of how this energy balance works, how you can actually put some energy into the black hole and actually get more energy out at the expense of the black hole. And the explanation, you know, for black holes is it's sort of intimately connected with the laws of black hole mechanics. So the first law essentially encapsulates conservation of energy and angular momentum. The second law, the area increase law, or sort of the consequences with entropy, that's also important. And it relies on certain energy conditions. But one thing that perhaps is sort of also relevant for this first study on superradiance is, does cosmic censorship hold in some of these interactions? And one thing is that all of the laws of black hole mechanics, the way we can sort of prove them in a mathematically well-motivated way, they all assume cosmic censorship. They assume that if you start interact with a black hole in some way, that no naked singularities form. You've always got a well-defined Cauchy evolution. So it's really a sort of a fascinating test bed to test dynamical strong field gravity. That's perhaps the motivation for the first results that I want to talk about. Okay, so why do we want to go beyond the linear regime? And I think, you know, the take-home message, you know, perhaps especially with related to massive particle field superradiance, at the end of the day, most of the interesting things that we can get, we don't really need it to go to nonlinear evolution. Really, all the studies that have been done at the linear level are essentially well-justified and well-motivated. And that's particularly if the changes to the metric happen on relatively long time scales compared to the other relevant time scales, which would be sort of the superradiant frequencies, the light crossing time. And I think a lot of the work that's been happening recently and is, you know, going to be happening in the future, you know, linear analysis is perfectly fine. But of course, there's some questions that we sort of really need the nonlinear sort of answers to address. And if I could put sort of a zeroth order synergy check that yes, you know, the assumptions that go into the fact that energy and angular momentum is conserved, the laws of black hole mechanics hold, that assumes cosmic censorship works, does that work out? And yes, it does. But then there's some questions that aren't necessarily obvious. I mean, the arguments that you can make where what the answer should be, but it's with a massive particles, there's exponential growth of the field. Exponential growth has to stop at some point. Does it evolve to a singularity? How does it shut off? How does this instability saturate? If there's a sufficient energy and angular momentum extraction from the black hole, that there's a significant energy in this cloud around the black hole, does that qualitatively change the picture? So other questions which we won't be able to address, unfortunately, is how stable is this hair? Is it stable on, you know, very long time scales? And that's particularly interesting for gravitational wave observation of binary compact objects. If black holes form, they develop significant amounts of this hair, and it's sort of metastable for orders, millions to billions of years, then these things could possibly survive and be visible in for the final stages of merger. If it's a lot less stable and it sort of decays perhaps through gravitational wave emission on shorter timescales, that's also very interesting because that could also be observed by LIGO and inferred by other means. Okay, so why is it complicated? What I mean by computational challenge is actually not complicated. It's not more complicated or complex necessarily than other things, but it's expensive. And the bottom line is really just the disparate timescales involved. So again, if we want to do a fully self-consistent study of these phenomena, we have to solve the Einstein equations, either in vacuum or coupled to matter. And so the Einstein, it's a relativistic theory, it respects the speed of light. So in any kind of numerical solution method, the scheme has to be able to take into account the fact that things can change on a light crossing time scale. Things can propagate at the speed of light. So you essentially have to build your time stepper that evolves the fields to take into account small changes that can happen and propagate at the speed of light. But for most of the interesting problems, in particular with massive particles, the time scale for the growth and development of this field is orders of magnitude longer than that. And so we have this sort of two timescale problem. Moreover, we can't accept, you know, there being for charge scalar superradiance, you can reduce the problem to spherical symmetry and then just brute force computation you can get around these timescales. But for the most interesting cases with Kerr black holes, we really have no symmetry restrictions. For the Proker field case that I'll show you, we actually did reduce the axisymmetry to get very long evolutions, but that's not the most interesting scenario. So there are also no symmetries that we can take advantage of. So the computational challenge is really just resources to actually solve the problem self-consistently in sort of a naive brute force way without trying to be very clever about things. It's a very, very challenging problem. So what we're going to do to start sort of getting some answers is we're actually also going to restrict to regions of the parameter space where we can get answers with reasonable computational resources today. So for the gravitational wave scattering example, what we're going to start with are near-extremal black holes. And actually, as I'll sort of show you sort of towards the end, perhaps the most interesting case would be extremal black holes. If we can get incredibly close to extremal, that's very challenging to model that. But we want to get to as close to extremal as we can so we can have the fastest growth rates possible. And we're going to have very large amplitude scattering. And so, you know, if you look at the kind of time scales we might need, we need to evolve things for about 100 times the characteristic scale of the black hole, the mass of the black hole.
So for extremal case, Andy Stramager recently talks a lot about extra symmetries which are present there and somehow trying to use them. Is it any use here?
I'd say probably like in asymptotically flat, if we were sort of interested in how things sort of evolve, say like with a scattering experiment. So we implode a wave with a sort of finely tuned frequency and see how it interacts. I don't think we can take advantage of it because the gravitational waves that we're going to be producing don't have those symmetries.
So it's just only near horizon regime.
Yeah, just in the near horizon regime. So, yeah. Okay, yeah. So in this case, we'll do sort of full 3D. There are no symmetries that we can take advantage of, but going close to extremal, we can feasibly get evolutions of order 100 m. For the massive particle cases, the problem is that the instability time scale is much, much slower than gravitational waves. And so we're going to be choosing a Broca field and restricting to the most unstable mode, the m equals 1 mode, and restricting to axisymmetry. And all of this will allow us to get to evolutions of 10 to the 5. So that sort of, if we wanted to look at, say, scalar fields, we'd have to go even further than that. And if we want to look at other modes, even more so. So this is sort of the best we can do at the moment. But even so, even if we just did this, we still have to be a bit smarter with the codes. We can't just sort of just take an existing Cartesian code that's been developed for binary mergers and apply it. And so we have to be a little bit better, and that's where we're going to get to this best technique. But just sort of a comment, if we're saying, let's say this was a problem that we wanted to tackle, we want to look at single black hole superradiance, we want to solve the problem, we want to really understand that, you wouldn't use a Cartesian code. That's sort of the stupid thing to do. So you'd actually want a code that sort of adapted to the problem, so you want sort of spherical polar-based coordinates. On the other hand, it actually takes a lot of time to write a full general Einstein solver from scratch. So we have this 3D Cartesian code. Can we get away with getting these answers without just starting from scratch with a new code? So this would be, if you wanted to start from the beginning, this is the way to go. But we didn't have that kind of time. So we figured, well, can we actually use our Cartesian code? And that's where this background error subtraction techniques is going to be useful in the sense that because initially the solution is dominated by a known analytic solution, the Kerr solution, we can take advantage of that and reduce the truncation error and effectively under-resolve the black hole significantly, so it becomes much more efficient. And so this technique can be applied. It doesn't have to be finite difference. So ours is going to be a finite difference generalized harmonic code. It doesn't have to be generalized harmonic. It could be BSSN. It could be pseudo-spectral methods. Any kind of code, this technique would work. And in fact, if someone wants to sort of, you know, clean house on the superradiant problem and start a new code from scratch, I'd say you'd still want to use this on top of that. So, you know, a well-adapted scheme, you're going to get a couple of orders of magnitude improvements. With BETS, you're going to get a couple of orders of magnitude on top of that. So this with BEST would be, I think, the ideal thing if someone wanted to really study this in all its detail. So let me just take a few minutes describing this algorithm. So now the next few slides, I'm actually not going to go into detail, but this is I've just taken from the first paper that we did, which described this technique. And the motivation there was to look at tidal disruption of stars by supermassive black holes. So these are just slides from that. I mean, I don't want to dwell on this. You know, if people are interested in this problem, I can do it. But the reason why I'm sort of haven't changed these slides for the new case is, I'm going to show a couple of results to just demonstrate how this works. So we did some explicit timings to show the speed increase that we get and how it really helps with the truncation error. I don't know if you've actually sort of compared BEST without BEST with a superradiant problem, but I don't know if you've got examples. It's like, now we show that it works, what's the point of doing it without it? So let me just give you a couple of words of motivation. So this was to You know, so we know that stars, like the sun, when they enter, they can be tidally disrupted by supermassive black holes, so 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes. And these tidal disruptions events are actually observed, or at least, you know, there are many of these events that astronomers think that they are, that's coming from tidal disruption of a star by a black hole. For most of the parameter space, you don't need, you know, full relativistic calculations. So these are the two main approaches that people have used to study these events. But for if things are just right, the star is just the right impact parameter, the disruption could start happening near the innermost stable circular orbit of the black hole. So the star could be self-bound pretty much until it starts interacting with the most relativistic part of the space-time. And so the signature of the disruption could have significant imprints of Kerr black holes on it. And so that was sort of the why we wanted to look at this problem is, can we, from these tidal disruption events, see something about strong field gravity? And so then the question is, well, what happens when a star gets disrupted very close to the ISCO? How do you answer that question? And it's in some sense there you need to do it self-consistently, because just before disruption, the self-gravity of the star is still important, but relativistic effects are important. So the way that people usually handle these tidal disruptions are either sort of in two ways. One, for the initial disruption, they usually use Newtonian hydrodynamics, and then model the black hole as some Newtonian point particle with a modified potential to try to incorporate some relativistic effects. So it's actually just Newtonian gravity. So you can self-consistently model the self-gravity of the star. After disruption, the star is unbound. And then if you want to look at the relativistic hydrodynamics, you can just model that on a Kerr background. And of course, here the back reaction is completely insignificant. That's not the problem here. But the problem is now, if you're now sort of just at the verge of these two regimes, when the self-gravity of the star is still important, but relativistic effects are important, how do you model that self-consistently? And here, self-consistent, well, now you do it, now you really should do it as general relativity. So the self-gravity of the star is coming from geometry, and the relativistic effects of its interaction are also geometry. And so we were sort of faced with this problem. You know, the back reaction is kind of insignificant, but if we want to self-consistently model it, we have to solve the Einstein equations. And so that led to this algorithm. And the point here was that the solution is completely dominated by this background black hole solution. But we know it analytically, so somehow we should be able to use that information to our advantage. And that's this algorithm. So let me sort of skip this and just actually show you what it is, because this is it. It's really, really simple. So the idea is, so this is the solution that we're after. I'm not showing the spatial dependence, so it does depend on all spatial coordinates. But let's assume that the solution we're after, there's some background solution that we know analytically. So capital Y, we know analytically, it can depend on time, it doesn't have to. Like a Kerr black hole, it doesn't. And now here's some deviation from that. It doesn't have to be a small perturbation. But the point is that this we know analytically, there's going to be some nonlinear effect, so we don't have analytical ways to find this little y, but this we do know analytically. Now we have some code, finite difference, pseudo-spectral, whatever, where we can take a discrete solution at time tn. This delta is the evolution operator, our discrete evolution operator, and we find an approximation to the solution, a discrete approximation at time tn plus 1. So what we do with this technique is first, the time we break down the time step, and this sort of F represents all the field. So in Einstein gravity, it's all the metric fields, it's hydrodynamics. You know, if you have Proca fields, it's the Proca field, etc. But what we do is we break down the evolution step into two pieces. One is we first evolve the analytic solution to the next time step. So we know the solution there, because there's no reason to do this by itself, because we know what it is. But the thing is, because we know the solution at the next time step analytically, we can exactly compute what the numerical error is in that discretization. So this is the numerical error in evolving the exact solution with this discrete operator. And then what we do is we evolve the full solution one time step and we subtract that. And so what we're doing here is we're modifying the equations, the discrete equations, by something which is of order truncation error. So in the limit where we go to infinite resolution, sort of the convergence limit, which is what you always want to do with numerics, this correction goes to zero. So we're not changing the equations. We're doing something at the level of the truncation error. But what this effectively is going to allow us to do is we can under-resolve this part by a lot. In other words, the error in a discrete evolution can be huge. But since we're subtracting it, it doesn't matter. And so that's what I said earlier. And one extra comment is that, so I've written it so it looks like something plus a perturbation. This actually doesn't have to be a small perturbation at all, because we don't want to, we want to be able to go into a nonlinear regime where this could perhaps eventually dominate. And you can actually even imagine a situation where this is zero. This algorithm will still work. It's kind of stupid. You wouldn't want to do it in that way. But then, because you're still evolving the full problem, and then you're just subtracting zero from it. So all the solution could be in this delta. So it doesn't care what this background is. It doesn't care how large it is.
So how do you know that the error you made that now you're correcting for didn't affect the evolution of this delta, small delta t?
Two answers. One is that this is something that's order the truncation error, or at least that's what it is in theory. So the way that we check it is, as usual, if we now get a discrete solution, we do convergence. So we say, is this converging to a continuum solution? And say with the Einstein equations, are the constraints converging to zero? So in some sense, at the end of the day, once we've got a numerical solution, we don't care what this delta was, we don't care what all these things are, but we have what we're proposing is a candidate solution. We have a sequence of them at different resolutions. Does it converge to the continuum solution? So it's the same kind of test that you do with any kind of scheme. And then you could see that if, with and without this thing, if this is somehow messing things up, you'd notice that. It's just the usual thing. This is, you've got a particular discretization method. With anything, even if you didn't use this algorithm, you'd have to show that you've got a solution that is within some error bar of the continuum solution, you have to show convergence, and we'll do the same thing here. And that's what we do. So we don't just blindly apply this. We still do convergence for everything.
I'm not sure I see where the savings is achieved, Franz. If you've got the, I mean, obviously, when computing the error, maybe you could make that fast and under-resolve the known solution, but if you want to resolve the dynamics to some accuracy or some refinement level, the bottom line, don't you still have to do that evolution at a very high resolution, potentially at a very high cost, and then subtracting the, isn't that just as expensive?
So if this piece requires high resolution, then yes. So in the limit where this starts to dominate the solution, you're not getting any savings. This algorithm, it's only going to help you so I'll show you a couple of examples with a disruption problem where, so throughout the disruption, even with this algorithm, we can't study the full disruption problem, but there it always works. And here actually kind of surprisingly, in the cases where we look at the super radiance, the changes the Kerr background solution by sort of up to 10% in the mass, and then there's a scalar cloud around it. And even then, it's still pretty efficient. But you can imagine situations. So let's say we applied it to a binary black hole spacetime, and we try to do it around each of these. And at some point, this is going to be an insignificant part of the solution. It's really going to be this. And then, in some sense, this is going to be a drag on the algorithm. So I think in the worst case, I won't discuss it here, but in the worst case, this will slow your code down by a factor of two because you're doing two time steps. But for example, we use mesh refinement, we set truncation error thresholds, and it's going to do what it needs to get a solution to within a certain accuracy. And so in some sense, if we're doing things sort of stupidly with this, we're doing an extra step for nothing, but it's still going to refine things such that this is resolved as accurately as needed. Kind of what I said there. So the stellar disruption problem. So the one case we could actually compare the full evolution to was a head-on axisymmetric collision. So take a supermassive black hole and a big star and just smash them together. It's not a very interesting problem, but because we could do this in axisymmetry, we could actually compare the two. And even though we were sort of taking two steps with best versus one, we still got a speed improvement. Oh, we cut the time down by a factor of 40. In the 3D case, we couldn't do the full 3D case. We didn't have the computational resource, but we estimated it would give us about a couple of orders of magnitude. Let me just show you. This is just to show you that there is an effect, and we'd still get the correct answer. But let me just show you exactly how it's affecting the truncation error. So here's just one snapshot of the evolution of a black hole colliding with the star. So this is axisymmetry. So these are just two halves of the different solutions, one without best, one with best. This is the symmetry axis. So there's the black hole, there's the star. And this is just showing the truncation error of one of the metric components. So again, with the mesh refinement, we say we set a truncation error level threshold. It adds as many levels as necessary to get it below. Here, I think we set it some probably 10 to the minus 6. You can see that this color scale goes from 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 12, a logarithmic scale. And so this is just the algorithm without, just the truncation error without best. So what it's going to do is it's going to resolve the star, it's going to resolve the black hole. But unsurprisingly, the black hole is dominating the solution. It's essentially all of the resolution is necessary to get the black hole resolved to within that level. But that's where the waste is, because we know the solution analytically. So with this technique, now we subtract and you can see the effect that this has on the truncation error. So you notice the effects of the refinement level. So it is resolving the star, but the black hole is completely under-resolved compared to before, but it doesn't matter because we're subtracting it. And just one cute animation. So this is then what Will did afterwards. Here, he looked at a grazing collision. This is now in full 3D. There's a star, there's a black hole. It's not a, from a tidal disruption perspective, it's not spectacular, but just for sort of a demonstration that this is actually doing it. The background is just for visual purposes. There, the black hole gets, the star gets stretched and absorbed by the black hole. So that's a fully 3D self-consistent calculation, and probably, I don't know how long this one took, probably a month or so on that time scale. Yeah, a few weeks with best. It would have probably been a few years without. So, okay. So that algorithm was key to both of these things that I'm going to be talking about now: the Kerr superradiance and the Proker field. And again, we didn't estimate exactly how much time we saved, but it was essential for that. Okay. So now, yeah.
So when you talk about nonlinearities, you talk about just gravitational nonlinearities, or you also introduce axiom potential.
So any nonlinearity right now we're not introducing an axion potential. So with the Proker field, it's just a mass okay. term. But in principle, yeah, it could be anything.
Do you track gravitational wave emission from
Yes. this? Yeah. So it's completely self-consistent. I'll get to that. So with axisymmetry, there's not going to be significant gravitational wave emission. We really want to break that, and that's some work that Will has been doing, and I'll show a couple of slides of that in the end. Okay, but so now for the Kerr superradiant case, so this again, now there are no bound states. This is just the interaction of a strong gravitational wave with the Kerr black hole. And so we're sort of interested more in theoretical questions about black hole dynamics. And perhaps sort of the key question is relates to this final state conjecture. I would say like if you, the most perhaps mathematician would say in mathematical relativity, this is one of the perhaps the leading unsolved questions in relativity. You might say it's the nonlinear stability of Kerr or the uniqueness properties of black holes. But as sort of the variant of the statement is this final state conjecture by Penrose. And what he was sort of thinking of is I take now four-dimensional asymptotic Einstein gravity, no matter. So we're just looking at the vacuum problem. We want to start with an initial Cauchy slice without any naked singularities on that slice. So we can do anything we want. We can have black holes on the initial slice. We can have huge amounts of gravitational radiation. So we want nonlinear interaction. So the gravitational waves can collapse to form black holes. And the question is, what is the final state? How does this evolve? Do naked singularities form? Or what happens? And this conjecture is that once all the nonlinear dynamics has happened, all the black holes that can merge have merged, they've collapsed to black holes, etc. What you're left with in the final state is a set of unbound black holes moving apart and radiation streaming to infinity. But moreover, each one of those black holes is settling down to a unique member of the Kerr family, the two-parameter Kerr family of solutions. And then the important thing about this conjecture is it's more than just the so-called no-hair theorems. And what I mean by the no-hair theorems is the ones, the Israel, Carter, Hawking, Robinson theorems. And what those theorems sort of state, and it's almost proven as a true theorem, that if you look at stationary spacetimes with event horizons, they uniquely have to be Kerr in four-dimensional asymptotic Einstein gravity. The thing about these no-hair theorems is no dynamics there. So if we want to sort of test the no-hair theorem, say, with gravitational waves, we can't be testing this theorem because there are no gravitational waves there. An isolated curl black hole is invisible to gravitational waves. So I think the only people that can honestly say they're testing the no-hair theorems are the Event Horizon people, telescope people, where there is no dynamics. But if you want to test gravitational waves, we really have to look at the dynamics. And so that's the dynamical part of the Einstein equations are crucial. Okay, so, you know, is this conjecture true? And I think most of us, yeah.
Sorry, can you clarify what this unbound means? That they just don't come together?
Right. So you wait long enough until things have settled to a final state. And so all the black holes that were bound, you wait long enough that they merge. Uh-huh. So they'll merge, they'll emit gravitational waves. There might be, you know, multiple phases of mergers. But at the end of the day, once all of that is over, you could have a set of isolated black holes, but they're not bound together. So they're all moving apart. So they're all sort of slowly moving to time-like infinity, I guess. And then all the gravitational waves that either were in the initial conditions or were produced by the mergers, that's streaming to null infinity. And so if you wanted to, like, or just perhaps for this way, the relevant sort of subset of this conjecture is for a single black hole, either the black hole forms or you do something, some nonlinear interaction, does it again settle bound down to a Kerr black hole? So that's sort of the restriction of that to one for a single black hole. So I think that from a physicist or perhaps astrophysicist perspective, I think we're pretty sure that Kerr black holes are stable. There've been decades of evidence, you know, looking at linear aspects of the problem. And numerics, there's been a lot of, especially black hole merger collisions, that show that this is likely true. But I think there are probably still certain regions of parameter space that haven't been well tested, and I'll get to one of them in this study. So there might be some less generic initial data where this is not true, but it seems to be true. In particular, I think where interesting things might happen is around extremal black holes or near extremal black holes. There's sort of a couple of reasons to think that might be the case. So one is the existence of these so-called zero-damp modes in the limit of extremal black holes. So these are the quasi-normal ring-down modes. The least damp mode in the limit where you approach an extremal black hole essentially becomes undamped. And so that there could be, you know, if we can form extremal black holes, you know, there's been suggestions that, well, the ring-down will last for a very long time, but it could even be that there's some turbulent aspects to the dynamics following that. And actually, extremal black holes themselves are unstable, the so-called Arrhetakis instability. It's a kind of a strange instability in that sort of fields across the horizon become non-smooth in some sense. We don't really notice it from outside, so it's more something about the interior. And it's perhaps also not surprising that super extreme will become naked singularity. So this is sort of a boundary between, you know, sort of the unhealthy part of the theory and the healthy part. So it's not surprising that something starts to go wrong there. But all of these things, and also with the note that the least damped quasi-normal, also this zero damped frequency plus the frequency that sort of marks the onset of superradiance coincide at the extremal limit. So it seems that all of these things might be connected, and that might be a place where interesting things happen with black holes.
Can you say something quantitative? When you say near extremal, how near do you have in mind?
So we're going to be doing something 0.99 with a spin parameter. And that's actually in terms of where, so like this is perhaps the most interesting, like where these two frequencies coincide. And you'll see that they're actually quite far apart at 0.99 yet. So it's not, we can start seeing interesting things. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to, you know, and I'll show you, well, a couple of reasons. It's difficult to add extra nines in these numerical simulations. And then just even at 0.99, we have problems when we try to go to very large amplitudes, more than 10%. So this is the idea. We start with a black hole in an appropriate basis. You know, if you scatter a spheroidal harmonic of a given L and M to leading order, it's going to interact with the black hole. There's going to be some amount that's absorbed, some that's scattered. There's not going to be mode coupling at linear order, so the same L M mode is going to be reflected. There'll be the power law tails mode coupling at the nonlinear level, but to leading order, we're just taking a given spheroidal harmonic, imploding it onto the black hole, and we want to see what happens coming off of it. Okay, super radiance. Again, this is not something that really needs much introduction, but again, this is So the idea is it's pretty simple. So actually, if you look at omega, that's sort of the frequency of the wave, over m, the azimuthal number. So omega over m is in some sense the angular velocity of this wave packet. Capital omega is the angular speed of the horizon. So if you scatter a wave that's essentially rotating slower than the black hole, that's when it can, you know, gain energy by interacting with the black hole. And in some sense, for black holes, as I mentioned before, in some sense, when this condition is satisfied, sort of the super radiant, the scattered field has to gain energy and angular momentum because of the laws of black hole mechanics. If it didn't, you'd violate the area theorem, essentially. The question is, okay, well, does this really happen? And sort of until recently, I guess, until the study, you know, all of the answers came from the linear regime. It wasn't necessarily fully self-consistent. So we want to know, is this all of this correct? And with energy conservation, you know, Einstein's gravity respects that. You might not be able to localize it, but it respects it. But the way in which this picture could break down is if this interaction produced a naked singularity. So is cosmic censorship upheld? Yes, so far it is. But then, okay, if it is upheld, if we have sort of very large amplitude waves, how efficient is the extraction? Are there some interesting phenomena? So those are some of the questions that we wanted to answer. Okay, so this is set up against the question. So we're just going to be looking at a single black hole, essentially the highest spin that we could reasonably do, so 0.99. We're going to take the details of the code. It's a single L equals M equals 2 mode. We're going to sort of center it at R equals 40 M, sort of a Gaussian wave packet in R of this wave. And we're going to pick sort of three initial frequencies of the wave and scatter this off the black hole and see what happens and vary the amplitude. In the case where we have the largest amplitude, this initial wave packet contributes to about 10% of the mass of the space-time. So the three frequencies, one is sort of an estimate for when we expect the maximal superradiance. One is sort of tuned to the least damped quasi-normal mode frequency of the black hole, and one, just as a sort of a counterpoint, is one where we don't expect superradiant. We expect more absorption. So here it's actually spinning faster than the black hole, and so we expect it to be absorbed. There's just sort of a couple of animations to illustrate. So this is one simulation, sort of four snapshots of the same simulation. This is through an equatorial slice, so looking sort of essentially down on the black hole. This is a polar slice. And these two horizontal panels, one is a Neumann-Penrose scalar psi 0. So this measures incoming waves. This is a Neumann-Penrose scalar 4, so it measures outgoing waves. So you can see now at t equals 0, this is our incoming wave packet. And then it's going to interact with the black hole, and then it becomes an outgoing wave. Right, so the wave goes in, interacts with the black hole, it scatters, and now you have an outgoing wave. So that's the basic setup. The first surprising thing is that Kerr black holes tend to produce square-shaped gravitational waves. that's a pure artifact of our coordinates. We use a spatial compactification where spatial infinity is actually a unit cube. So the wave fronts are actually spherical, so don't worry about that. This is actually a nice animation. So this is made by Ralph Kaler at CAIPAC when Will was still there. And this is showing the same thing, but now sort of a 3D visualization. So the blue waves is going to be the incoming wave packet, so psi 0. The red's going to be the outgoing packet. And we're also showing the horizon, the apparent horizon shape. So I'll play it twice. One wants to just show the waves coming in. So there's the initial data. There's the incoming wave. It interacts with a black hole. And now we have this outgoing wave that's coming out. So you can sort of see the three-dimensional structure of these quadrupole waves. And sort of the twisting is because, you know, there's angular momentum in the space-time. I'm going to play it again. The interesting thing that you perhaps didn't notice is now pay close attention to the actual horizon. So this is a 0.99 spinning black hole. The horizon is axisymmetric, so you don't see the spin. But now as this gravitational wave interacts with the black hole, it actually distorts it quite significantly. And it's a non-axisymmetric distortion. So then you'll start to see, you actually see sort of what looks like, it looks like it's starting to spin, but actually what's happening is then you actually notice that it's actually spinning. So notice you can see it start wobbling around. And that's because there's quite a large perturbation, around 10% of the energy of the space-time. And so it's creating a large axisymmetric distortion of the horizon of the black hole. Okay, so a couple of the results. So these first two plots are just, well, let me just, there's a lot of details here. So let me just say that the take-home message is, in the limit of zero amplitude, we get consistency with a linear theory. And in this particular case, with these parameters, we expect a 40% enhancement in the energy. So that's increased its energy by 40% due to superradiance, and we see this. And then the take-home message is, if we go to larger amplitudes, the efficiency decreases. And actually, the leading order explanation is quite simple. And so again, you know, we have a wave packet that's sort of spread out over quite a range relative to the size of the black hole. But all of this, we've tuned the wave to be sort of most, we've tuned the frequencies to that of the initial black hole. So if we have a large energy wave packet, you know, as this initial, the leading part of the wave starts to interact with the black hole, it's starting to extract energy from the black hole and spin. So the black hole starts to spin down. And so the trailing part of the wave is not as well tuned to the frequency of the black hole when it gets there. So because the black hole is spinning down as it's happening, it's sort of less efficient. That's sort of the leading explanation for why, you know, the maximum energy angular momentum extraction as we go to large masses becomes less efficient than the linear theory.
So the animations that you were showing were for the maximum
energy? Yeah, I think it's sort of like a 10% case. So. Right, so in the limit where it's very, very small, you also wouldn't see the horizon oscillations.
What's the conformal thin sandwich constraint?
Oh, sorry, yeah. So that was, okay, so the way in which we get self-consistent initial data. So this is a sort of York-Bechnerowitz type procedure. You choose a background metric, and then you decompose the metric and the extrinsic curvature sort of into a, you write your metric as something that's conformal to some guess for your initial data, and you decompose the extrinsic curvature. And then what the Hamiltonian momentum constraints of the Einstein equations then reduce to these sort of nice elliptic equations. And so what we do is we take a linearized Tucholsky wave, essentially, for that initial wave train. We take a Kerr black hole, and that's our background solution. That doesn't satisfy the constraints, but then we solve then solving the equation, but then we get corrections to that metric that then does satisfy the Einstein equation. Incidentally, that's why when you start the animation, you can see there's a little bit of dynamics going around the black hole, and that's because of the correction to the constraint solved. So in principle, if we started this wave very, very, very far away, it really would be a stationary isolated black hole. But that also would be, the further away it is, the more evolution we have to get it to the black hole. But that's essentially, that's what that is.
Franz, how are you computing the mass of the black hole? What is the definition for the mass? Is it the reducible mass or something else?
So both. So actually, I'll show you we compute the mass. With the reducible mass, we measure the area. So we measure the dynamical horizon. So we do this dynamical horizons formalism. We measure the area and the properties of the dynamical horizon, then use the SMAR formula, essentially, to get the total mass.
Which J do you put in the SMAR formula?
Oh, so yeah, so in this case, because of the initial conditions, the spin is always going to be aligned with the z-axis. So we assume that there's this azimuthal killing.
So take the prime vector and plug it into.
Right, and so during the interaction phase, you know, it's not a killing vector. But we just apply the formulas blindly. And so it's okay, so here's the initial state. This is the interaction. So you can perhaps say during this interaction, you want to take those formulas with a grain of salt. And also, as you can see like this, so this is the irreducible mass. So it should always increase. And you can see some kind of funky behavior there.
I was going to ask about that.
Right, and
for the non-experts, can you define the irreducible mass and the...
Yes, good question. So the irreducible mass is essentially the area of the black hole. So if you say, let's take the relationship between area and mass, say, for a Schwarzschild black hole. We measure the area, and let's define a mass based on that. And then by the second law of black hole mechanics, or Hawking's area theorem, that always has to increase.
Sorry, as an expert,
okay,
so, area, you mean the area of the marginal trapped surface, or how
to... The original laws of black hole mechanics were the area of the event horizon.
Right.
So we don't compute event horizons. Yeah. We're computing dynamical horizons.
Right.
And there's also an equivalent of the area increase law with dynamical horizons.
Okay,
but yeah.
Horizon? Is it marginal trap surface or it's
something? Yeah, yes. It's the world tube of all these marginal trap surfaces. So we find the apparent horizon at each slice,
right,
and then we build up this thing. So yeah, so technically this is all based on the apparent horizon.
But it looks like it's decreasing there.
Right. So this is the most largest amplitude case that we could do. And so here we're starting to have problems that the apparent horizon finder is not working. So here at that point, we lose track of it, but at least not long enough that the code doesn't crash. This is the case which isn't super radiant. So here it's essentially absorbing all of the energy. And so this is the total mass of the black hole. This is just the piece that's in the area. So the difference between these two is essentially how much rotational energies could in principle be extracted. So you can see in this case, it absorbs 10%. If we try to go more than this, then in this regime where the horizon finder starts to have problems, at some point it just fails completely and then we're dead. Because we rely on the horizon to excise the initial singularity.
So this is a
technical issue. So here we don't trust what's going on. It's more the initial and the late times that you can say that's what you should be looking at.
So what happens is you lose track and then find it again after some time.
Yeah, or we not completely lose track of it, but so we try to find it within a certain tolerance. And we usually have a pretty tight constraint on that. In this regime, it can't find it that accurately. And so we relax the constraints. And so it gets a sort of a more approximate version of it. Which is still good enough that we can excise within it. That's a key thing for stability, is that we don't get anywhere near singularities inside the black hole. But at some point, if we lose it, then things fail. This is the usual absorption case. Here's a super radiant case. So you can see the black hole lost mass. It also lost angular momentum. But perhaps in the interesting case, the one thing which I think does deserve further study is the case where we sort of tuned it towards a quasi-normal mode frequency. So in this case, it's sort of the least change relative to these kinds of cases. There's still some absorption. The area does increase a little bit. But the interesting thing is in this case, this is where we see the most dynamics in the horizon. So here are a couple of plots to show sort of the intrinsic geometry of the apparent horizon now. So this is the ratio of the polar to equatorial circumference. For a Kerr black hole, it's distorted, so it's some value. For example, it's an extremal black hole, it's that value. It's a constant. And this is some measure of some overall curvature of the horizon. Again, this is what it would be for an extremal black hole. And so these are the three cases, you know, sub-superradiant, superradiant. But the one which is tuned close to the quasi-normal frequency, we see you get these very large oscillations and very large curvatures developing in the horizon. And so what it sort of almost seems to be, and you can imagine now if we could extrapolate this to the extremal limit, this is probably almost like a zero mode of the horizon. This might be one of these zero damp modes, which is also sort of an isentropic perturbation. So sort of something where we don't change the entropy. But this, if it's sort of a zero mode, in principle, you can make it arbitrarily large amplitude. And you can imagine then if we could feed in a large enough amplitude, this might be a way to actually break the black hole to violate convex censorship. Because again, it's kind of surprising. This is inducing very large oscillations, but from the perspective of the ingoing and outgoing wave packet, it's basically just reflected. So there's less interaction.
If I must suggest one more thing to track could be the extrinsic curvature, the radial angular part of the extrinsic curvature. Mm-hmm. Just at the horizon, get a vector field, but
okay.
Just look at its components instead.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that would be interesting. So I think this is sort of the interesting case, and I suspect I'm guessing that we would be able to violate cosmic censorship, but it'd probably be an infinitely fine-tuned case. We'd have to go too extremal and completely fine-tune the thing. So I don't think it's going to be generic, but this is at least one open question which hints that there's some interesting behavior going on here. Okay, so how am I doing for time? Okay, great. Yeah, that's good. Okay. Okay, so now the next part is, so perhaps now finally, at least with 15 minutes, getting to the part that's perhaps most relevant to this conference, and that's sort of massive particle super radiance. So So this is, I mean, exactly the same idea. So from the perspective of the black hole, it's the same, exactly the same physics. If you have a mode which carries less sort of angular velocity relative to the black hole, it interacts with the black hole, it can gain energy and angular momentum at the expense of rotation. But of course, the thing here that's very interesting is now if you had a mass parameter, and for appropriate parameters relative to the mass of the black hole, the self-interaction of the field acts as a confining potential. And so the scattering experiment, if it happens, the field sort of confines itself to the vicinity of the black hole, and you can have multiple interactions. And so then you get exponential growth of this field around the black hole.
It's not self-interaction. It's interaction with gravity.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, so what I mean is the mass term. That's a self-interaction piece. So a massless field, for instance, I would say it doesn't have a self-interaction component. And then you can have, you know, you could have super radiant scattering, but there's not going to be any trapping. So it's you need some, the field has to have some nonlinear interaction, and if it's as simple as a mass term, but you need something like that to trap the field around the black hole.
I guess it's semantics. We don't call call mass self-interaction.
Okay.
So it's okay.
Okay. So
semantics.
Okay. In any case, there's something that allows a field to be trapped, and it's not something extra you add. The field has a mechanism to do it by itself. Okay, so to start again, some questions that we might want to ask for a nonlinear study is how efficient is the extraction, and how does the instability saturate? So it's going to be exponential initially. Exponentials, they have to end at some point unless there's a singularity. So how does it turn off? I mean, there've been a lot of arguments, since the beginning, and perhaps some more sort of concrete arguments recently. By people in the audience that suggest that because the time scales are relatively slow for these particle fields. So the gravitational wave case is the most efficient. In the example that I showed you before, we sort of amped it up to make it very obvious because we had near extremal black holes and we had large amplitude fields. With massive particles, the growth rates are much, much slower. And so you can imagine it's always going to be sort of a quasi-adiabatic, quasi-stationary interaction with a black hole. And so in that case, you might imagine that at any stage of this interaction, a linear-like analysis is always going to be valid, whether it's relative to the initial black hole, or now at some point you've got a black hole with a scalar cloud, it's still a relatively slow interaction. But there have been some studies that suggest that perhaps it's not going to saturate in a very smooth fashion. Also got on the next slide, if you have now, a true self-interaction, you might have these Bose-Nova type situations. So things might actually end up sort of being more explosive once you get to saturation. And so there the argument is now if you've got a large mass in this cloud, things could be qualitatively different from just a small little bit of a cloud around the black hole. So those are some of the questions that we wanted to answer. In this case, the answers turned out to be nothing exciting. So that's the punchline, is that it really is consistent with this picture. We don't really need the linear analysis. We don't see anything like this, but again, we don't have those kinds of potentials where you might expect that, so it's not too surprising. So let me just show you the results. First, and as I mentioned before, even with BEST and even with these things, it's still a challenging simulation. So we've again chosen things to make this instability happen as quickly as possible. So we've decided to actually have a pair of massive vector fields. And then what we do is we fine-tune the phases of them such that they're out of phase by pi by 2. So the stress energy tensor is going to be like cosine squared plus sine squared, so it's going to be axisymmetric. And in that case, even though the fields have structure, they conspire to produce an axisymmetric stress tensor. So the space-time is axisymmetric, so we can get away with an axisymmetric evolution. And the easiest way to do that is just using a single complex scalar field. But that's not because of the complex field, that's just a trick, just a simple way to do it. And so, if there was a complex vector field out there, there'd be no reason why nature would have this kind of phase match. So this is something that we entirely impose to make things easy. And again, we're going to choose a single mode, the one that grows the fastest. And then again, we're going to choose mass parameters and spin parameters such that we get the most rapid growth possible. So here with these parameters, the linear theory suggests that in order 10 to the 5 m evolution is necessary. Okay, this Einstein equations, this is the Broca field. This condition that we impose, we assume that there's a killing vector phi, so the Kerr killing vector, m is the azimuthal number, so m is going to be 1, and we just impose that condition. And there are details about the code that I can talk about later. So here's one example. So this is a polar cut through the black hole. There's a black hole. There's an initial cloud, order of magnitude. So we start with a small seed field and just evolve. And this is now not a very exciting animation because it just happens as what you might expect. It's a very slow quasi-stationary process. This field is going to be slowly growing in amplitude, and at some point it's going to saturate. And by that, all that's going to mean, so it is evolving. But the color is just slowly changing. So perhaps the most relevant information is just to show how this actually works in time. So this is this is t in units of 10 to the 4 m. So this is up to 10 to the 5 m. This is the amount, the change in the energy of the black hole, negative the change in the energy of the black hole. This blue curve is the energy in the field for the various cases. So the larger the mass parameters, the quicker the instability happens, but also the closer the frequency of this field is to the onset of superradiance. So it starts to spin the black hole down, and then there's less energy to extract before the superradiance condition stops being satisfied. So they grow rapidly, then they saturate. The less massive ones is, there's more energy to extract before the black hole spins down to a point where the superradiant condition is not satisfied, but it's a slower growth. So this just shows you we're getting energy and angular momentum extraction from the black hole. In the largest case here, the Broca field gains about 10% of the energy of the mass of the black hole. And just to show, there's a lot of stuff in these figures, but these are just to show that it really is following what you'd expect from a linear analysis. So one is just to say, like, how does the instability turn off? How does it saturate? Well, one thing to measure is, so if we measure the flux, this ratio of the flux of energy and angular momentum of the field across the horizon, at least at the linear level, it should be the angular velocity of the field. So if, for example, just take any one of these curves, say here, so this is the measured flux across the horizon. You can see it's essentially roughly a constant. This is the initial angular velocity of the horizon, so it's going much faster. So the superradiant conditions here are satisfied. It starts to extract energy, so the black hole starts to spin down, and as soon as they become commensurate, it stops. So it's just a very mild sort of turning off of this nonlinear instability. And this part is also almost demonstrating, so if we take this sort of quasi-stationary estimates of the evolution of the black hole, and we can sort of estimate what the linear theory predicts for initial properties, this is showing final properties, irreducible mass, total mass, spin, and these are the four dots from the simulations. They essentially line up on the linear analysis. So it's essentially saying that nothing surprising is happening here. Okay, so the last couple of slides, so this is now, so again, most of everything that I've shown was Will's fault, or his, thanks to him. The rest of the stuff is entirely what Will has been doing, so this is not my work at all. But this is now trying to estimate the gravitational wave emission. So there are several interesting things about the gravitational wave emission. One is, once you form a black hole and this cloud starts to grow, again, this phase alignment that we enforce to make it axisymmetric is not generic. So generically, even if there's a complex field, there will be some preferential mode that grows, and it won't be axisymmetric. And so an m equals 1 mode is going to radiate gravitational waves. So there's going to be gravitational wave emission when this black hole is formed. And so to estimate that, I guess he sort of, once the instability saturated, he sort of measured, say, the real component of the field and moved that to a 3D code and was able to sort of estimate the gravitational wave emission. And so what is perhaps relevant here is the ratio of the growth rate of the cloud versus the reduction in the amplitude of the cloud due to gravitational wave emission, or the dissipation in the cloud. So these are competing effects. So the crowd is extracting angular momentum from the black hole that's growing, but now it's losing energy to gravitational waves. And so, you know, the bottom line, so this is the essentially the power that's being extracted from the black hole. The black dots are sort of the estimates of the gravitational wave emission. So you can see this is much lower than, so the gravitational wave is subdominant. So essentially what this is telling you, the bottom line is that the cloud is going to grow relatively efficiently and on a longer time scale, then it's going to lose energy to black holes and sorry to gravitational waves. So just want to sort of a quick sort of a acute estimate for, say for example, this the first binary merger that LIGO saw that formed the black hole of mass 0.7, and if we take these again a very finely tuned field, so sort of optimally sort of tuned for this thing. In this case, if we sort of started from a single particle, in about 7 hours, the superradiant instability would grow to saturation, and it would gain an energy of almost about 2% of the mass of the black hole. So this is actually similar to before, but in this case, it's not quite, I think it was 0.06 for a 0.99 black hole. So this is a bit less for a 0.07 black hole. But then over the next 11 hours, it's going to lose all of this to gravitational wave emission at about 180 hertz. And so this is something I think which is definitely measurable by LIGO. If you just look at the energy, right, 2% of the mass of this black hole, that might be a challenge to, well, I'm not sure, it probably isn't that much of a challenge over an 11-hour period. But of course, this is perhaps a very fine-tuned parameter. More realistically, this could be mega years. I mean, it might even be... Here he is.
So this, what you're showing now, is using the best algorithm, these results that you have?
Yeah, it's still using the best algorithm.
So how can it work so fast and everything you're doing?
Yeah. This is now an estimate. So you didn't do a simulation of 0.7, okay. Right? So you just took the results and scaled it down to 0.7. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I did like one lower step. So. It turns out for like the non-relative physics clouds where you know the alpha is or u is small, then it's not that sensitive to the spin of the black hole. Mm-hmm. And so the gravitational waves wouldn't be that different.
Okay, and then so the final thing, this is now unpublished work by Wallen. So actually now this is now a fully self-consistent 3D simulation. But I guess what you did was you evolved the initial linear phase of the instability with the axisymmetric code up to a certain point, then sort of just took, say, the real part of the field, lifted it to a 3D code, and then the remainder self-consistently in a 3D code, right? So 3D, so an order of magnitude less evolution, say, you know, 10 to the 4, that's feasible with 3D. But the axisymmetric case gets us to this point. And you can see that the actual full 3D result is relatively consistent with the axisymmetric case. And this animation is now going to show, I guess it gives a warning, if any of you have epileptic seizure issues, you might want to turn away. So there's a black hole, there's a Proker cloud. And so this is now going to show both the gravitational wave emission from a 3D case. As the cloud grows, and so, yeah. this is now starting up here, sort of evolving up here. So the colors are going to get more intense. That's because the amount of energy in this Broca cloud is growing. The gravitational wave emission is growing. So at least in this one case, the 3D results are sort of confirming what we're getting with the 2D case.
Is this long beat frequency real or an artifact of the movie? It seems like it beats, and then it slows, and then it beats, and then it slows.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly just the one frequency, so I think mainly just the visualization artifact. You can actually see your CD in sort of this subdominant mode, so there's a very small, you know, what you call transition gravitational. But yeah, I'm not sure you can see that visualization.
Yeah. And I guess the internal... the oscillation frequency is much, much higher than the frame rate that you've got here. So there's going to be some...
Yeah.
Okay, that might be what's going
on. Yeah. Okay, so I guess this will hopefully be published soon. to conclude, you know, I think perhaps for the gravitational wave scattering case, that one interesting regime we still haven't explored yet, and that's approaching extremal and trying to excite that zero mode. I think there's some really interesting physics that's going to be happening there. It's probably not of relevance in an astrophysical situation, but just for the study of black holes, it's interesting. I think what these results are sort of hinting at for particle superradiance is that pretty much everything that people have been doing with these quasi-adiabatic linear approximations is good. Of course, we haven't explored much of the parameter space. I think the one place where numerics is still going to be interesting is in the merger problem. So there are a lot of ifs that are going to happen here. So if these particles exist, if they can extract a significant amount of energy, and then if these clouds are stable and survive some of these interactions that might happen. So some very interesting recent results if they have these clouds and they come in together, there could be interactions between the clouds that could drain the energy. But if they survive all of this, and so if these clouds are, say, metastable for, say, up to a giga-year or something, then the binaries that LIGO sees might have significant energy in these scalar clouds around them. And that would be, to understand what's happening with a gravitational wave signature, you'd need the full nonlinear problem for that. So that's the one region of parameter space, I think, where we need numerics. But that's conclusion. Thank you.
So it's really interesting right now. But the apparent horizon, do you know why you lose track of it? Is there something happened to the shape, convexity, or the star shape nature of it? Why?
That's Wilkins' answer. I think it doesn't get close to breaking our star shape ANSET. So yeah, we assume its radius as a function of theta and phi. I don't think it's getting close to that. Yeah, I don't know if you've got any guesses.
I mean, it is getting very distorted. Oh.
Yeah.
And I think it might
be getting close to that. Yeah. And I should say, it's not, it isn't the most robust algorithm in a sense. It's just a very simple flow algorithm. And so, possibly, if to resolve this, the distorted shape, you need more resolution in the horizon finder, but this flow method is sort of like a parabolic equation. And so there's some numerical issues there that make it not an ideal type of thing. And so it works very well when you've got a good guess for the shape and it's not changing very much. So I don't think it's really a sign that something, it's not close to a naked singularity, but it's there's definitely interesting dynamics that's working. It's something that we need a better horizon finder to actually resolve that.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank you again.
Thank you.